Please welcome Rachel Ross.
No. A hard act to follow. He was born in 1913 in hardscrabble New York City, the son of Polish immigrants. And he had a sister 2 years older. She was born in 1915, the daughter of Russian immigrants in Winnipeg, Canada, which was at that time the immigrant capital of the world. As soon as their family got permission, they moved to San Francisco and settled there. Now, in those days, there were no antibiotics, so an infected pimple or boil could fell you. And that's what happened to his father when he was just 3 months old. So he was left with his firm but very caring mother and his older sister, and he felt very loved. He was in the embrace of love of that family. They were very poor, but he enjoyed playing stickball in the streets of New York City, and she supported the family as a dressmaker. And he was surrounded by women who came to be measured for their dresses, and he loved women, and they treated him very well. He grew up feeling really good about himself and enjoying life until he was 13 years old when his mother was stricken with breast cancer. And in those days, there was nothing that you could do. She was sent to the poor hospital, and he and his sister took a train as often as they could to see her until she passed. And then he was essentially an orphan at 13. He felt very bereft of the family love that he had known, and he, the rest of his life, set out to try to recreate that on his own. His extended family separated he and his sister, and because everybody was very poor, his sister went to live someplace, and he, for the next 2 years, slept on sofas and the floor of the living rooms of the extended family, and he felt grateful for the shelter, but in essence, an interloper. He didn't feel he had a family. When his sister turned 18 and he was 16, they decided, let's raise ourselves, let's be together. And they managed to get a little one-room apartment in a tenement in New York City, and he dropped out of school and started working in the garment industry. A lot of anti-Semitism at that time. That was the only place he could find a job. In those days, it was the Jewish people who ran the garment industry, the Italians ran the trucking industry, and the Irish dominated the police. That's how it was back then. She, over in San Francisco, also dropped out of school at 16 because she had a unique talent for designing clothing and was making a pretty good living at 16 with her little studio in the living room of her parents' home. So she was helping to support the family, and people came to have their dresses made. Back in New York City, it's the beginning of the Depression. He's 16 years old, and all around him, there are people sleeping on benches and in soup lines and dealing with life. He managed to go to school at night, graduate high school, put himself through college, and put himself through law school. He believed that hard work and education would be the key to happiness. He didn't have much time for romance. Few people did. Then, when the war broke out, World War II, he was ready for an adventure. He enlisted, and because of his law degree and his smarts and his initiative, they sent him to officer school, and he became a captain, and he was sent to Great Britain, to handle supply logistics for the Allied command. So he was stationed in outside of London throughout the war. And that's where he began to understand romance. The British women they loved the American GIs, and they sang great pub songs. And that's where he had his first real romantic romps, and he was the grateful recipient for the first time of oral sex, which he described as exquisite. He also had a serious relationship with a beautiful British woman named Sheila, who had a great sense of humor and sang great pub songs, but it wasn't really the one. He knew that. And as soon as the war was over and the camps were liberated, he left Sheila, and he was sent to handle supply and logistics at a base outside of Dachau. And because he was an attorney, although not practicing, he had a special interest in the military trials that were immediately set up to try the officers who staffed the death camps. He also had an opportunity to witness firsthand the gas chambers, and he saw the piles of clothing and hair and teeth neatly stacked by the orderly Nazis ready for processing. As a Jewish young man, it was very, very unnerving. He was chatting up a pretty German girl in a bar one night. She was complaining that the American GIs had taken one of her pianos for use in their rec room. And he wanted to ask her the question that the whole world was asking at that time. Didn't you know? How could you not know? How could you not smell? How could you not see what was going on, the boxcars coming to the camp? And she said, they told us they were criminals and communists. We didn't know. We're just the little people. What could we do? And that was pretty difficult for him to process. Another moment, during the trials, he was waiting outside as the SS officers were being led in for their day in court. And one of them smiled very broadly to a young German woman standing next to him, and he winked at her, and she patted her heart and blew him a kiss and was very distraught, probably his wife or girlfriend. And he was so stunned, and it was so difficult for him to imagine how could they have found love. How could their love have flourished around such brutality and inhumanity? But certainly they loved each other, and he couldn't imagine how she could love him. It was very difficult for him in Germany, and he was very happy to be released and discharged and returned to civilian life, which he did. Went back to New York City, went back to the garment industry. But he was in his mid-30s, and he wanted to replicate. He wanted to find. Did you just ding me? Huh? Okay. Sorry. So he wanted to find that love. He wanted to recreate that love that he knew. And he was restless. He had a relationship going with a nice Jewish girl from Montreal whose father promised to buy them a house if they got married. But she wasn't the one. So he was searching for something, and his army buddy called him from California and said, come on out here. I've started a shoulder pad company. Shoulder pads were really big in the 40s. And California's fabulous. They've got these new freeways going up. They're great. So he bought an old beat-up Chrysler and headed west, told the Montreal girl, I'll send for you. He got there. It was great. He loved California. He sent for the Montreal girl, but when she arrived on his doorstep with her mother in tow, that ended that, and he was again searching for love. So his army buddy said one night, let's go on a double date. There's this designer on Sunset Boulevard that I sell shoulder pads to. I really like her partner, and you can go out with her. Let's do a double date. And he said, okay. So 2 days before the double date, they drive by to drop off some shoulder pads, and the army buddy brings the designer out to the car to meet him, and he thought she was pretty good looking. She thought he was okay because she was really grumpy at that time. She had been dieting and not eating, and so she was really just not herself. But 2 days later, when he came to pick her up and she saw him with her eyes wide open and all her faculties, she was blown away. It was love at first sight. He felt the same way. They danced the rumba and cha-cha-cha swing for the next 6 months. She loved how he was down for everything, and in 6 months they were married. They honeymooned in Catalina, and when they had their first daughter, their first child, she started making children's clothing instead of couture wedding dresses, and he went into business with her and expanded that enterprise, and they ended up selling all over the country and in Japan, and were able to sustain their family. They had two daughters and a son, put them all through college without any debt. It was possible in those days. And they also were able to travel around the world. They went down the Nile on a riverboat and climbed the heights of Machu Picchu and went to China and all kinds of places. And they were very happy. They never strayed from each other. They were married for 67 years. He died. She died first, 3 weeks short of her 97th birthday, peacefully in her sleep. And he died 14 months later at the age of 99. Now, the reason I know about this story, this love supreme, is because Len and Estelle were my parents. But the reason I know the juicy details, like oral sex is exquisite and all these other things, is that my father, Len, sat down at the age of 82 and did a brain dump. He wrote his autobiography using these fingers on an electric typewriter stuck in caps lock. I said to him, don't you want, I can show you how to do it. He said, no, it saves time, saves time. He did it in 4 days. And on the fifth day, he took those 102 pages to Kinko's and had it printed and bound and shared with us. So I've summarized the love parts of his story. There's a lot more to it. But I'd like to end this story with his exact words, which I've memorized, about the search for love. This love of ours is like an unassailable fortress. Estelle is my best friend and a great companion. We've had our spats along the way about little things, but always managed to reconcile or give in to each other's point of view. She is patient, kind, loving, and understanding, and she has a great sense of humor. I'm so glad I waited so long for her.